much. Here you are in Paris.
And if I have come, my dear father, said Gerard, drawing closer to Monsieur Noirtier, do not complain, for it is for you that I came, and my journey will save you.
Ah, indeed, said Monsieur Noirtier, stretching himself out at his ease in the chair. Really, pray tell me all about it, Monsieur le Magistrat, for it must be interesting.
Father, you have heard tell of a certain club of Bonapartists held in the Rue Saint-Jacques?
Number 53. Yes, I am vice-president.
Father, your coolness makes me shudder.
Why, my dear boy, when a man has been proscribed by the mountaineers, has escaped from Paris in a haycart, been hunted in the land of Bordeaux by Monsieur Robespierre's bloodhounds, he becomes accustomed to most things. But go on, what about the club in the Rue Saint-Jacques?
Why, they induced General Canel to go there, and General Canel, who quitted his own house at 9 o'clock in the evening, was found the next day in the Seine.
And who told you this fine story?
The king himself.
Well, then, in return for your story, continued Noirtier, I will tell you one.
My dear father, I think I already know what you are about to tell me.
Ah, you have heard of the landing of the Emperor?
Not so loud, father, I entreat of you, for your own sake as well as mine.
Yes, I heard this news, and knew it even before you could. For 3 days ago I posted from Marseille to Paris with all possible speed, and half desperate because I could not send with a wish 200 leagues ahead of me the thought which was agitating my brain.
3 days ago?
You are crazy. Why, 3 days ago the Emperor had not landed.
No matter. I was aware of his project.
How did you learn it?
By a letter addressed to you from the Isle of Elba.
To me?
To you. And which I discovered in the pocketbook of the messenger. Had that letter fallen into the hands of another, you, my dear father, would probably, ere this, have been shot.
Villefort's father laughed. Come, come, said he. It appears that the Restoration has learned from the Empire the mode of settling affairs speedily.
Shot, my dear boy. You go ahead with a vengeance.
Where is this letter you talk about? I know you too well to suppose you would allow such a thing to pass you.
I burnt it, for fear that even a fragment should remain, for that letter must have effected your condemnation,
and the destruction of your future prospects, replied Noirtier.
Yes, I can easily comprehend that.
But I have nothing to fear whilst I have you to protect me.
I do better than that, sir. I save you.
You do?
Why, really, the thing becomes more and more dramatic. Explain yourself.
I must refer again to the club in the Rue Saint-Jacques.
It appears that this club is rather a bore to the police.
Why didn't they search more vigilantly?
They would have found, they have not found, but they are on the track.
Yes, that's the usual phrase. I know it well.
When the police is at fault, it declares that it is on the track, and the government patiently awaits the day when it comes to say, with a sneaking air, that the track is lost.
Yes, but they have found a corpse. The general has been killed, and in all countries they call that a murder.
A murder, do you call it?
Why, there is nothing to prove that the general was murdered.
People are found every day in the Seine, having thrown themselves in or having been drowned from not knowing how to swim.
Father, you know very well that the general was not a man to drown himself in despair, and people do not bathe in the Seine in the month of January.
No, no, do not mistake. This death was a murder in every sense of the word.
And who thus designated it?
The king himself.
The king?
I thought he was philosopher enough to allow that there was no murder in politics.
In politics, my dear fellow, you know as well as I do, there are no men but ideas, no feelings but interests.
In politics we do not kill a man, we only remove an obstacle, that is all.
Would you like to know how matters have progressed?
Well, I will tell you.
It was thought reliance might be placed in General Canel. He was recommended to us from the Isle of Elba. One of us went to him and invited him to the Rue Saint-Jacques, where he would find some friends. He came there, and the plan was unfolded to him of the leaving Elba, the projected landing, etc.
When he had heard and comprehended all to the fullest extent, he replied that he was a royalist. Then all looked at each other. He was made to take an oath and did so, but with such an ill grace that it was really tempting Providence to swear thus, and yet, in spite of that, the general was allowed to depart free, perfectly free. Yet he did not return home. What could that mean? Why, my dear fellow, that on leaving us he lost his way, that's all. A murder? Really, Villefort, you surprise me. You, a deputy procureur, to found an accusation on such bad premises. Did I ever say to you, when you were fulfilling your character as a royalist and cut off the head of one of my party, my son, you have committed a murder? No. I said, very well, sir, you have gained the victory. Tomorrow, perchance, it will be our turn.
But, father, take care when our turn comes. Our revenge will be sweeping.
I do not understand you.
You rely on the usurper's return?
We do.
You are mistaken. He will not advance 2 leagues into the interior of France without being followed, tracked, and caught like a wild beast.
My dear fellow, the Emperor is at this moment on the way to Grenoble. On the 10th or 12th he will be at Lyon, and on the 20th or 25th at Paris.
The population will rise.
Yes. To go and meet him.
He has but a handful of men with him, and armies will be dispatched against him.
Yes, to escort him into the capital. Really, my dear Gerard, you are but a child. You think yourself well informed, because a telegraph has told you 3 days after the landing, the usurper has landed at Cannes with several men. He is pursued. But where is he? What is he doing? You do not know well, and in this way they will pursue him to Paris without drawing a trigger. Grenoble and Lyon are faithful cities and will oppose to him an impassable barrier. Grenoble will open her gates to him with enthusiasm. All Lyon will hasten to welcome him. Believe me, we are as well informed as you, and our police is as good as your own. Would you like a proof of it? Well, you wish to conceal your journey from me, and yet I knew of your arrival 30 minutes after you had passed the barrier. You gave your direction to no one but your postillion, yet I have your address, and in proof I am here the very instant you are going to sit at table. Ring, then, if you please, for a second knife, fork, and plate, and we will dine together.
Indeed, replied Villefort, looking at his father with astonishment. You really do seem very well informed,
eh? The thing is simple enough. You who are in power have only the means that money produces. We who are in expectation have those which devotion prompts. Devotion, said Villefort with a sneer. Yes, devotion, for that is, I believe, the phrase for hopeful ambition.
And Villefort's father extended his hand to the bell rope to summon the servant whom his son had not called. Villefort arrested his arm. Wait, my dear father, said the young man. One other word.
Say it.
However ill-conducted the royalist police is, they yet know one terrible thing.
What is that?
The description of the man who, on the morning of the day when General Canel disappeared, presented himself at his house.
Oh, the admirable police have found out that, have they?
And what may be that description? Brown complexion, hair, eyebrows and whiskers black, blue frock coat buttoned up to the chin, rosette of an officer of the Legion of Honour in his buttonhole, a hat with wide brim, and a cane.
Ah, that is it, said Noirtier. And why then have they not laid hands on the individual?
Because yesterday, or the day before, they lost sight of him at the corner of the Rue Coq Héron.
Didn't I say your police was good for nothing?
Yes, but still it may lay hands on him.
True, said Noirtier, looking carelessly around him. True, if this individual were not warned as he is. And he added with a smile, he will consequently change looks and costume. At these words he rose and put off his frock coat and cravat, went towards a table on which lay all the requisites of the toilette for his son, lathered his face, took a razor, and with a firm hand cut off the whiskers that might have compromised him and gave the police so decided a trace. Villefort watched him with alarm, not divested of admiration. His whiskers cut off, Noirtier gave another turn to his hair, took, instead of his black cravat, a coloured neckerchief which lay at the top of an open portmanteau, put on, in lieu of his blue and high-buttoned frock coat, a coat of Villefort's, of dark brown, and sloped away in front, tried on before the glass a narrow-brimmed hat of his son's which appeared to fit him perfectly, and leaving his cane in the corner where he had deposited it, he made to whistle in his powerful hand a small bamboo switch, which the dandy deputy used when he walked, and which aided in giving him that easy swagger which was one of his principal characteristics. "Well," he said, turning towards his wondering son when this disguise was completed, "well, do you think your police will recognize me now?" "No, father," stammered Villefort. "At least I hope not." "And now, my dear boy," continued Noirtier, "I rely on your prudence to remove all the things which I leave in your care." "Oh, rely on me," said Villefort. "Yes, yes. And now I believe you are right, and that you have really saved my life. But be assured I will return the obligation to you hereafter." Villefort shook his head. "You are not convinced yet? I hope at least that you may be mistaken. Shall you see the king again?" "Perhaps. Would you pass in his eyes for a prophet?"
"Prophets of evil are not in favor at the court, father."
"True. But some day they do them justice. And supposing a second restoration, you would then pass for a great man."
"Well, what should I say to the king?
Say this to him. Sire, you are deceived as to the feeling in France, as to the opinions of the towns and the prejudices of the army. He whom in Paris you call the Corsican ogre, who at Nevers is styled the usurper, is already saluted as Bonaparte at Lyons and emperor at Grenoble. You think he is tracked, pursued, captured. He is advancing as rapidly as his own eagles. The soldiers you believe dying with hunger, worn out with fatigue, ready to desert, increase like atoms of snow about the rolling ball which hastens onward. Sire, go, leave France to its real master, to him who did not buy but acquired it. Go, sire, not that you incur any risk, for your adversary is powerful enough to show you mercy, but because it would be humiliating for a grandson of St. Louis to owe his life to the man of Arcola, Marengo, Austerlitz. Tell him this, Gerard, or rather, tell him nothing. Keep your journey a secret. Do not boast of what you have come to Paris to do, or have done. Return with all speed, enter Marseille at night, and your house by the back door, and there remain quiet, submissive, secret, and above all, inoffensive. For this time, I swear to you, we shall act like powerful men who know their enemies. Go, my son. Go, my dear Gerard, and by your obedience to my paternal orders, or, if you prefer it, friendly counsels, we will keep you in your place. This will be," added Noirtier with a smile, "one means by which you may a second time save me, if the political balance should one day place you high and me low. Adieu, my dear Gerard, and at your next journey, alight at my door."
Noirtier left the room when he had finished, with the same calmness that had characterized him during the whole of this remarkable and trying conversation. Villefort, pale and agitated, ran to the window, put aside the curtain, and saw him pass, cool and collected, by two or three ill-looking men at the corner of the street, who were there, perhaps, to arrest a man with black whiskers and a blue frock coat and hat with broad brim. Villefort stood watching, breathless, until his father had disappeared at the Rue Bussy. Then he turned to the various articles he had left behind him, put at the bottom of his portmanteau his black cravat and blue frock coat, threw the hat into a dark closet, broke the cane into small bits and flung it in the fire, put on his travelling cap, and calling his valet, checked with a look the thousand questions he was ready to ask, paid his bill, sprung into his carriage which was ready, learned at Lyon that Bonaparte had entered Grenoble, and in the midst of the tumult which prevailed along the road, at length reached Marseille,
prey to all the hopes and fears which enter into the heart of man with ambition and its first successes. 13. The 100 Days. Monsieur Noirtier was a true prophet, and things progressed rapidly as he had predicted. Everyone knows the history of the famous return from Elba, a return which, without example in the past, will probably remain without imitation in the future. Louis XVIII made but a faint attempt to parry this unexpected blow. The monarchy he had scarcely reconstructed tottered on its precarious foundation, and it needed but a sign of the emperor to hurl to the ground all this edifice composed of ancient prejudices and new ideas. Villefort, therefore, gained nothing save the king's gratitude, which was rather likely to injure him at the present time, and the cross of the Legion of Honour, which he had the prudence not to wear, although Monsieur de Blacas had duly forwarded the brevet. Napoleon would, doubtless, have deprived Villefort of his office had it not been for Noirtier, who was all-powerful at the court. And thus the Girondin of 93 and the Senator of 1806 protected him who so lately had been his protector. All Villefort's influence barely enabled him to stifle the secret Dantès had so nearly divulged. The king's procureur alone was deprived of his office, being suspected of royalism. However, scarcely was the imperial power established, that is, scarcely had the emperor re-entered the Tuileries and issued his numerous orders from that little cabinet into which we have introduced our readers, and on the table of which he found Louis XVIII's snuff-box half full, the Marseillais began to rekindle the flames of civil war, and it required but little to excite the populace to acts of far greater violence than the shouts and insults with which they assailed the royalists whenever they ventured abroad. Owing to this change, the worthy shipowner became at that moment, we will not say all-powerful, because Morel was a prudent and rather a timid man, so much so that many of the most zealous partisans of Bonaparte accused him of moderation, but sufficiently influential to make a demand in favour of Dantès. Villefort retained his place, but his marriage was put off until a more favourable opportunity. If the emperor remained on the throne, Gerard required a different alliance to aid his career. If Louis XVIII returned, the influence of Monsieur Saint-Marin and himself became double, and the marriage must be still more suitable. The deputy procureur was, therefore, the first magistrate of Marseille, when one morning his door opened and Monsieur Morel was announced. Anyone else would have hastened to receive him, but Villefort was a man of ability, and he knew this would be a sign of weakness. He made Morel wait in the antechamber, although he had no one with him, for the simple reason that the king's procureur always makes everyone wait, and after a quarter of an hour passed in reading the papers, he ordered Monsieur Morel to be admitted. Morel expected Villefort would be dejected. He found him, as he had found him 6 weeks before, calm, firm, and full of that glacial politeness, that most insurmountable barrier which separates the well-bred and the vulgar man. He had penetrated into Villefort's cabinet, convinced the magistrate would tremble at the sight of him. On the contrary, he felt a cold shudder all over him when he beheld Villefort seated, his elbow on his desk and his head leaning on his hand. He stopped at the door. Villefort gazed at him as if he had some difficulty in recognizing him. Then, after a brief interval, during which the honest shipowner turned his hat in his hands, "Monsieur Morel, I believe," said Villefort. "Yes, sir." "Come nearer," said the magistrate with a patronizing wave of the hand, "and tell me to what circumstance I owe the honor of this visit." "Do you not guess, monsieur?" asked Morel. "Not in the least. But if I can serve you in any way, I shall be delighted. Everything depends on you." "Explain yourself, pray, monsieur," said Morel, recovering his assurance as he proceeded. "Do you recollect that a few days before the landing of His Majesty the Emperor, I came to intercede for a young man, the mate of my ship, who was accused of being concerned in a correspondence with the Isle of Elba? And what was the other day a crime, is today a title to favour." "You then served Louis XVIII, and you did not show any favour. It was your duty. Today you serve Napoleon, and you ought to protect him. It is equally your duty. I come, therefore, to ask what has become of him." Villefort made a violent effort. "What is his name?" said he. "Tell me his name." "Edmund Dantès." Vifor would evidently rather have stood opposite the muzzle of a pistol at 25 paces than have heard this name pronounced, but he betrayed no emotion. "Dantès," repeated he. "Edmund Dantès?" "Yes, monsieur." Vifor opened a large register, then went to a table, from the table turned to his registers, and then, turning to Morel, "Are you quite sure you are not mistaken, monsieur?" said he, in the most natural tone in the world. Had Morel been a more quick-sighted man, or better versed in these matters, he would have been surprised at the king's procureur answering him on such a subject, instead of referring him to the governor of the prison or the prefect of the department. But Morel, disappointed in his expectations of exciting fear, saw only in its place condescension. Vifor had calculated rightly. "No," said Morel, "I am not mistaken. I have known him 10 years, and the last 4 he has been in my service. Do not you recollect I came about 6 weeks ago to beseech your clemency, as I come today to beseech your justice? You received me very coldly. Oh, the royalists were very severe with the Bonapartists in those days." "Monsieur," returned Vifor, "I was then a royalist because I believed the Bourbons not only the heirs to the throne, but the chosen of the nation. The miraculous return of Napoleon has conquered me. The legitimate monarch is he who is loved by his people." "That's right," cried Morel. "I like to hear you speak thus, and I augur well for Edmund from it." "Wait a moment," said Vifor, turning over the leaves of a register. "I have it. A sailor who was about to marry a young Catalan girl. I recollect now, it was a very serious charge." "How so?" "You know that when he left here he was taken to the Palais de Justice." "Well?" "I made my report to the authorities at Paris, and a week after he was carried off."
"Carried off?" said Morel. "What can they have done with him?"
"Oh, he has been taken to Fenestrelle, to Pignerol, or to the Ile Saint-Marguerite. Some fine morning he will return to assume the command of your vessel."
"Come when he will, it shall be kept for him. But how is it he has not already returned? It seems to me the first care of government should be to set at liberty those who have suffered for their adherence to it."
"Do not be too hasty, Monsieur Morel," replied Vifor. "The order of imprisonment came from high authority, and the order for his liberation must proceed from the same source. And as Napoleon has scarcely been reinstated a fortnight, the letters have not yet been forwarded."
"But," said Morel, "is there no way of expediting all these formalities, of releasing him from his arrest?"
"There has been no arrest."
"How?"
"It is sometimes essential to government to cause a man's disappearance without leaving any traces, so that no written forms or documents may defeat their wishes.
It might be so under the Bourbons, but at present it has always been the same, my dear Morel, since the reign of Louis XIV.
The emperor is more strict in prison discipline than even Louis himself, and the number of prisoners whose names are not on the register is incalculable. Had Morel even any suspicions, so much kindness would have dispelled them.
"Well, Monsieur de Vifor, how would you advise me to act?" asked he.
"Petition the minister."
"Oh, I know what that is. The minister receives 200 every day and does not read 3.
"That is true. But he will read a petition countersigned and presented by me."
"And will you undertake to deliver it?"
"With the greatest pleasure. Dantès was then guilty, and now he is innocent, and it is as much my duty to free him as it was to condemn him."
"But how shall I address the minister?"
"Sit down there," said Vifor, giving up his place to Morel, "and write what I dictate."
"Will you be so good?"
"Certainly. But lose no time. We have lost too much already."
"That is true. Only think that perhaps this poor young man is pining in captivity."
Vifor shuddered at this picture, but he was too far gone to recede. Dantès must be crushed beneath the weight of Vifor's ambition. Vifor dictated a petition in which, from an excellent intention, no doubt, Dantès' services were exaggerated, and he was made out one of the most active agents of Napoleon's return. It was evident that at the sight of this document, the minister would instantly release him. The petition finished, Vifor read it aloud. "That will do," said he. "Leave the rest to me. Will the petition go soon? Today? Countersigned by you? The best thing I can do will be to certify the truth of the contents of your petition." And sitting down, Vifor wrote the certificate at the bottom. "What more is to be done? I will answer for everything." This assurance charmed Morel, who took leave of Vifor and hastened to announce to old Dantes that he would soon see his son. As for Vifor, instead of sending to Paris, he carefully preserved the petition that so fearfully compromised Dantes in the hopes of an event that seemed not unlikely, that is, a second restoration. Dantes remained a prisoner and heard not the noise of the fall of Louis XVIII's throne. Twice during the 100 days had Morel renewed his demand, and twice had Vifor soothed him with promises. At last there was Waterloo, and Morel came no more. He had done all that was in his power, and any fresh attempt would only compromise himself uselessly. Louis XVIII remounted the throne. Vifor demanded and obtained the situation of king's procureur at Toulouse, and a fortnight afterwards married Renée. Danglars comprehended the full extent of the wretched fate that overwhelmed Dantes, and, like all men of small abilities, he termed this a decree of providence. But when Napoleon returned to Paris, Danglars' heart failed him, and he feared at every instant to behold Dantes eager for vengeance. He therefore informed M. Morel of his wish to quit the sea and obtained a recommendation from him to a Spanish merchant, into whose service he entered at the end of March, that is, 10 or 12 days after Napoleon's return. He then left for Madrid and was no more heard of. Fernand understood nothing except that Dantes was absent. What had become of him? He cared not to inquire. Only during the respite the absence of his rival afforded him, he reflected partly on the means of deceiving Mercedes as to the cause of his absence, partly on plans of emigration and abduction, as from time to time he sat sad and motionless on the summit of Cape Faro, at the spot from whence Marseille and the village de Catalan are visible, watching for the apparition of a young and handsome man, who was for him also the messenger of vengeance. Fernand's mind was made up. He would shoot Dantes and then kill himself. But Fernand was mistaken. A man of his disposition never kills himself, for he constantly hopes. During this time the Empire made a last appeal, and every man in France capable of bearing arms rushed to obey the summons of their Emperor. Fernand departed with the rest, bearing with him the terrible thought that perhaps his rival was behind him and would marry Mercedes. Had Fernand really meant to kill himself, he would have done so when he parted from Mercedes. His devotion and the compassion he showed for her misfortunes produced the effect they always produce on noble minds. Mercedes had always had a sincere regard for Fernand, and this was now strengthened by gratitude. "My brother," said she, as she placed his knapsack on his shoulders, "be careful of yourself, for if you are killed, I shall be alone in the world." These words infused a ray of hope into Fernand's heart. Should Dantes not return, Mercedes might one day be his. Mercedes remained alone upon this bare plain, which to her eyes never appeared so barren as now, with the mighty sea stretching to the horizon. Quite dissolved in tears, like Niobe, she wandered without ceasing about the little Catalan village, halting at one time under the fierce heat of the southern sun, standing upright, motionless and dumb as a statue, her gaze fixed on Marseille, at another, sitting on the shore, listening to the moaning of the sea, eternal as grief itself, and asking herself continually whether she would not be better to cast herself in, to let the deep open and engulf her, rather than to suffer thus all the cruelties of waiting without hope. It was not want of courage that prevented her putting this resolution into execution, but her religious feelings came to her aid and saved her. Caderousse was, like Fernand, enrolled in the army, but being married and 8 years older, he was merely sent to the frontier. Odantes, who was only sustained by hope, lost all hope at Napoleon's downfall. 5 months after he had been separated from his son, and almost at the very hour at which he was arrested, he breathed his last in Mercedes' arms. Monsieur Morel paid the expenses of his funeral and a few small debts the poor old man had contracted. There was more than benevolence in this action. There was courage, for to assist even on his deathbed the father of so dangerous a Bonapartist as Dantès was stigmatized as a crime. 14. In the Dungeons. A year after the restoration of Louis XVIII, a visit was made by the Inspector General of Prisons. Dantès heard from the recesses of his cell the noises made by the preparations for receiving him, sounds that at the depth where he lay would have been inaudible to any but the ear of a prisoner who could distinguish the plash of the drop of water that every hour fell from the roof of his dungeon. He guessed something uncommon was passing among the living, but he had so long ceased to have any intercourse with the world that he looked upon himself as dead. The inspector visited the cells and dungeons one after another of several of the prisoners, whose good behavior or stupidity recommended them to the clemency of the government. The inspector inquired how they were fed and if they had anything to demand. The universal response was that the fare was detestable and that they required their freedom. The inspector asked if they had anything else to demand. They shook their heads. What could they desire beyond their liberty? The inspector turned smilingly to the governor. "I do not know what reason government can assign for these useless visits. When you see one prisoner, you see all. Always the same thing, ill-fed and innocent. Are there any others?" "Yes, the dangerous and mad prisoners are in the dungeons. Let us visit them," said the inspector with an air of fatigue. "I must fulfill my mission. Let us descend." "Let us first send for two soldiers," said the governor. "The prisoners sometimes, through mere uneasiness of life, and in order to be sentenced to death, commit acts of useless violence, and you might fall a victim." "Take all needful precautions," replied the inspector. Two soldiers were accordingly sent for, and the inspector descended a stair so foul, so humid, so dark, that the very sight affected the eye, the smell, and the respiration. "Oh," cried the inspector, "who can live here? A most dangerous conspirator, a man we are ordered to keep the most strict watch over, as he is daring and resolute." "He is alone?" "Certainly." "How long has he been there?" "Nearly a year." "Was he placed here when he first arrived?" "No, not until he attempted to kill the turnkey."
"To kill the turnkey?"
"Yes, the very one who is lighting us. Is it not true, Antoine?" asked the governor.
"True enough. He wanted to kill me," replied the turnkey.
"He must be mad," said the inspector.
"He is worse than that. He is a devil," returned the turnkey.
"Shall I complain of him?" demanded the inspector.
"Oh, no. It is useless. Besides, he is almost mad now, and in another year he will be quite so."
"So much the better for him. He will suffer less," said the inspector.
He was, as this remark shows, a man full of philanthropy, and in every way fit for his office.
"You are right, sir," replied the governor, "and this remark proves that you have deeply considered the subject. Now, we have in a dungeon about 20 feet distant, and to which you descend by another stair, an abbé, ancient leader of a party in Italy, who has been here since 1811, and in 1813 he went mad, and the change is astonishing. He used to weep, he now laughs. He grew thin, he now grows fat. You had better see him, for his madness is amusing."
"I will see them both," returned the inspector. "I must conscientiously perform my duty."
This was the inspector's first visit. He wished to display his authority.
"Let us visit this one first," added he.
"Willingly," replied the governor, and he signed to the turnkey to open the door. At the sound of the key turning in the lock and the creaking of the hinges, Dantès, who was crouched in a corner of the dungeon, raised his head.
at the sight of a stranger lighted by two turnkeys, accompanied by two soldiers, and to whom the governor spoke bareheaded, Dantès, who guessed the truth, and that the moment to address himself to the superior authorities was come, sprang forward with clasped hands. The soldiers presented their bayonets, for they thought he was about to attack the inspector, and the latter recoiled two or three steps. Dantès saw he was represented as a dangerous prisoner, then, infusing all the humility he possessed into his eyes and voice, he addressed the inspector and sought to inspire him with pity. The inspector listened attentively, then, turning to the governor, observed, "He will become religious. He is already more gentle. He is afraid and retreated before the bayonets. Madmen are not afraid of anything. I made some curious observations on this at Charenton." Then, turning to the prisoner, "What do you demand?" said he. "What crime I have committed, to be tried, and if I am guilty, may be shot. If innocent, I may be set at liberty." "Are you well fed?" said the inspector. "I believe so. I know not, but that matters little. What matters really, not only to me, but to everyone, is that an innocent man should languish in prison, the victim of an infamous denunciation." "You are very humble today," remarked the governor. "You are not so always. The other day, for instance, when you tried to kill the turnkey..." "It is true, sir, and I beg his pardon, for he has always been very good to me. But I was mad."
"And you are not so any longer?"
"No. Captivity has subdued me. I have been here so long."
"So long? When were you arrested, then?" asked the inspector.
"The 28th of February, 1815, at 2:30 in the afternoon."
"Today is the 30th of June, 1816. Why, it is but 17 months."
"Only 17 months," replied Dantès. "Oh, you do not know what is 17 months in prison, 17 ages, rather, especially to a man who, like me, had arrived at the summit of his ambition, to a man who, like me, was on the point of marrying a woman he adored, who saw an honourable career open before him, and who loses all in an instant, who sees his prospects destroyed, and is ignorant of the fate of his affianced wife, and whether his aged father be still living. 17 months' captivity to a sailor accustomed to the boundless ocean is a worse punishment than human crime ever merited. Have pity on me, then, and ask for me not indulgence, but a trial. Let me know my crime and my sentence, for incertitude is worse than all."
"We shall see," said the inspector. Then, turning to the governor, "On my word, the poor devil touches me. You must show me the proofs against him."
"Certainly, but you will find terrible notes against him."
"Monsieur," continued Dantès, "I know it is not in your power to release me, but you can plead for me. You can have me tried, and that is all I ask."
"Light me," said the inspector.
"Monsieur," cried Dantès, "I can tell by your voice you are touched with pity. Tell me at least to hope."
"I cannot tell you that," replied the inspector. "I can only promise to examine into your case."
"Oh, I am free. Then I am saved."
"Who arrested you?"
"Monsieur Villefort. See him and hear what he says."
"Monsieur Villefort is no longer at Marseille. He is now at Toulouse."
"I am no longer surprised at my detention," murmured Dantès, "since my only protector is removed."
"Had Monsieur de Villefort any cause of personal dislike to you?"
"None. On the contrary, he was very kind to me."
"I can, then, rely on the notes he has left concerning you?"
"Entirely."
"That is well. Wait patiently, then."
Dantès fell on his knees and prayed earnestly. The door closed, but this time a fresh inmate was left with Dantès. Hope.
"Will you see the register at once?" asked the governor, "or proceed to the other cell?"
"Let us visit them all," said the inspector. "If I once mounted the stairs, I should never have the courage to descend."
"Ah, this one is not like the other, and his madness is less affecting than the reason of his neighbour. What is his folly? He fancies he possesses an immense treasure. The first year he offered government £1,000,000, £40,000, for his release. The second, two. The third, three, and so on, progressively. He is now in his fifth year of captivity. He will ask to speak to you in private and offer you £5,000,000.
How curious! What is his name?
L'Abbé Faria, number 27, said the inspector. It is here. Unlock the door, Antoine.
The turnkey obeyed, and the inspector gazed curiously into the chamber of the mad abbé. In the center of the cell, in a circle traced with a fragment of plaster detached from the wall, sat a man whose tattered garments scarcely covered him. He was drawing in this circle geometrical lines, and seemed as much absorbed in his problem as Archimedes when the soldier of Marcellus slew him. He did not move at the sound of the door, and continued his problem until the flash of the torches lighted up with an unwonted glare the sombre walls of his cell. Then, raising his head, he perceived with astonishment the number of persons in his cell. He hastily seized the coverlid of his bed and wrapped it round him.
"What do you demand?" said the inspector.
"I, monsieur?" replied the abbé with an air of surprise. "I demand nothing. You do not understand," continued the inspector. "I am sent here by government to visit the prisoners and hear the requests of the prisoners."
"Oh, that is different," cried the abbé, "and we shall understand each other, I hope."
"There now," whispered the governor, "it is just as I told you."
"Monsieur," continued the prisoner, "I am the Abbé Faria, born at Rome. I was for 20 years Cardinal Spada's secretary. I was arrested, why I know not, in 1811. Since then I have demanded my liberty from the Italian and French government."
"Why from the French government?"
"Because I was arrested at Piombino, and I presume that, like Milan and Florence, Piombino has become the capital of some French department."
"Ah," said the inspector, "you have not the latest intelligence from Italy."
"They date from the day on which I was arrested," returned the Abbé Faria. "And as the emperor had created the kingdom of Rome for his infant son, I presume that he has realized the dream of Machiavel and Caesar Borgia, which was to make Italy one vast kingdom."
"Monsieur," returned the inspector, "Providence has changed this gigantic plan you advocate so warmly. It is the only means of rendering Italy happy and independent, very possibly. Only I am not come to discuss politics, but to inquire if you have anything to ask or to complain of."
"The food is the same as in other prisons, that is, very bad. The lodging is very unwholesome, but on the whole passable for a dungeon. But it is not that which I speak of, but a secret I have to reveal of the greatest importance."
"We are coming to the point," whispered the governor. "It is for that reason I am delighted to see you," continued the abbé, "although you have disturbed me in a most important calculation, which, if it succeeded, would possibly change Newton's system. Could you allow me a few words in private?"
"What did I tell you?" said the governor.
"You knew him," returned the inspector.
"What you ask is impossible, monsieur," continued he, addressing Faria.
"But," said the abbé, "I would speak to you of a large sum, amounting to 5,000,000.
"The very sum you named," whispered in his turn the inspector.
"However," continued Faria, perceiving the inspector was about to depart, "it is not absolutely necessary we should be alone. Monsieur the governor can be present."
"Unfortunately," said the governor, "I know beforehand what you are about to say. It concerns your treasures, does it not?"
Faria fixed his eyes on him with an expression that would have convinced anyone else of his sanity.
"Doubtless," said he. "Of what else should I speak?"
"Monsieur l'inspecteur," continued the governor. I can tell you the story as well, for it has been dinned in my ears for the last 4 or 5 years. That proves, returned the abbe, that you are like the idols of Holy Writ, who have ears and hear not.
The government does not want your treasures, replied the inspector. Keep them until you are liberated.
The abbe's eyes glistened. He seized the inspector's hand. But what if I am not liberated, cried he, and am detained here until my death? Had not government better profit by it? I will offer 6 millions, and I will content myself with the rest.
On my word, said the inspector in a low tone, had I not been told beforehand this man was mad, I should believe what he says.
I am not mad, replied Faria, with that acuteness of hearing peculiar to prisoners. The treasure I speak of really exists, and I offer to sign a treaty with you in which I promise to lead you to the spot you shall dig, and, if I deceive you, bring me here again. I ask no more.
The governor laughed. Is the spot far from here?
100 leagues.
It is not a bad idea, said the governor.
If every prisoner took it into his head to travel 100 leagues, and their guardians consented to accompany them, they would have a capital chance of escaping.
The scheme is well known, said the governor, and Monsieur l'Abbé has not even the merit of its invention. Then, turning to Faria, I inquired if you are well fed, said he.
Swear to me, replied Faria, to free me if what I tell you prove true, and I will stay here whilst you go to the spot.
Are you well fed? Repeated the inspector.
Monsieur, you run no risk, for, as I told you, I will stay here, so there is no chance of my escaping.
You do not reply to my question, replied the inspector impatiently.
Nor you to mine, cried the abbe. You will not accept my gold? I will keep it for myself. You refuse me my liberty? God will give it me.
And the abbe, casting away his coverlid, resumed his place and continued his calculations.
What is he doing there? Said the inspector.
Counting his treasures, replied the governor. Faria replied to this sarcasm by a glance of profound contempt.
He has been wealthy once, perhaps, said the inspector,
or dreamed he was, and awoke mad.
After all, said the inspector, if he had been rich, he would not have been here.
Thus finished the adventure of the Abbé Faria. He remained in his cell, and this visit only increased the belief of his insanity. Caligula or Nero, those treasure-seekers, those desirers of the impossible, would have accorded to the poor wretch, in exchange for his wealth, the liberty and the air he so earnestly prayed for. But the kings of modern ages, retained within the limits of probability, have neither the courage nor the desire. They fear the ear that hears their orders and the eye that scrutinizes their actions. Formerly, they believed themselves sprung from Jupiter and shielded by their birth. But nowadays, they are not inviolable. It has always been against the policy of despotic governments to suffer the victims of their policy to reappear. As the Inquisition rarely suffered their victims to be seen with their limbs distorted and their flesh lacerated by torture, so madness is always concealed in its cell. From whence, should it depart, it is conveyed to some gloomy hospital where the doctor recognizes neither man nor mind in the mutilated being the jailer delivers to him.
The very madness of the Abbé Faria, gone mad in prison, condemned him to perpetual captivity. The inspector kept his word with Dantès. He examined the register and found the following note concerning him. Edmond Dantès, violent Bonapartist, took an active part in the return from Elba. The greatest watchfulness and care to be exercised. This note was in a different hand from the rest, which proved it had been added since his confinement. The inspector could not contend against this accusation. He simply wrote, "Nothing to be done."
This visit had infused new vigour into Dantes. He had till then forgotten the date, but now, with a fragment of plaster, he wrote the date 30th July 1816 and made a mark every day in order not to lose his reckoning again. Days and weeks passed away, then months. Dantes still waited. He at first expected to be freed in a fortnight. This fortnight expired. He reflected the inspector would do nothing until his return to Paris, and that he would not reach there until his circuit was finished. He, therefore, fixed 3 months. 3 months passed away, then six more. During these 10 months, no favourable change had taken place, and Dantes began to fancy the inspector's visit was but a dream, an illusion of the brain. At the expiration of a year, the governor was changed. He had obtained the government of Ham. He took with him several of his subordinates, and amongst them Dantes' jailer. A fresh governor arrived. It would have been too tedious to acquire the names of the prisoners. He learned their numbers instead. This horrible place consisted of 50 chambers. Their inhabitants were designated by the number of their chamber, and the unhappy young man was no longer called Edmond Dantes. He was now number 34. 15. Number 34 and number 27. Dantes passed through all the degrees of misfortune that prisoners, forgotten in their dungeon, suffer. He commenced with pride, a natural consequence of hope, and a consciousness of innocence. Then he began to doubt his own innocence, which justified in some measure the governor's belief in his mental alienation. And then, falling into the opposite extreme, he supplicated not heaven, but his jailer. Dantes entreated to be removed from his present dungeon into another, for a change, however disadvantageous, was still a change, and could afford him some amusement. He entreated to be allowed to walk about, to have books and instruments. Nothing was granted. No matter, he asked all the same. He accustomed himself to speak to his fresh jailer, although he was, if possible, more taciturn than the former. But still, to speak to a man, even though mute, was something. Dantes spoke for the sake of hearing his own voice. He had tried to speak when alone, but the sound of his voice terrified him. Often, before his captivity, Dantes' mind had revolted at the idea of those assemblages of prisoners composed of thieves, vagabonds, and murderers. He now wished to be amongst them, in order to see some other face besides that of his jailer. He sighed for the galleys, with their infamous costume, their chain, and the brand on the shoulder. The galley slaves breathed the fresh air of heaven and saw each other. They were very happy. He besought the jailer one day to let him have a companion, were it even the mad abbe. The jailer, though rude and hardened by the constant sight of so much suffering, was yet a man. At the bottom of his heart he had often compassionated the unhappy young man who suffered thus, and he laid the request of number 34 before the governor. But the latter sapiently imagined that Dantes wished to conspire or attempt an escape, and refused his request. Dantes had exhausted all human resources, and he then turned to God. All the pious ideas that had been so long forgotten returned. He recollected the prayers his mother had taught him, and discovered a new meaning in every word. For in prosperity, prayers seem but a mere assemblage of words, until the day when misfortune comes to explain to the unhappy sufferer the sublime language by which he invokes the pity of heaven. He prayed and prayed aloud, no longer terrified at the sound of his voice, for he fell into a species of ecstasy. He laid every action of his life before the Almighty, proposed tasks to accomplish, and at the end of every prayer introduced the entreaty oftener addressed to man than to God, "Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive them that trespass against us." Yet in spite of his earnest prayers, Dantes remained a prisoner. Then a gloomy feeling took possession of him.
He was simple and without education. He could not, therefore, in the solitude of his dungeon and of his own thoughts, reconstruct the ages that had passed, reanimate the nations that had perished, and rebuild the ancient cities that imagination renders so vast and stupendous, and that pass before our eyes, illuminated by the fires of heaven, as in Martin's pictures. He could not do this, he whose past life was so short, whose present so melancholy, and his future so doubtful. 19 years of light to reflect upon in eternal darkness. No distraction could come to his aid. His energetic spirit, that would have exulted in thus revisiting the past, was imprisoned like an eagle in a cage. He clung to one idea, that of his happiness, destroyed without apparent cause by an unheard-of fatality. He considered and reconsidered this idea, devoured it, so to speak, as Ugolino devours the skull of the Archbishop Roger in the Inferno of Dante. Rage succeeded this. Dante's uttered blasphemies that made his jailer recoil with horror, dashed himself furiously against the walls of his prison, attacked everything and chiefly himself, and the least thing, a grain of sand, a straw, or a breath of air that had annoyed him. Then the letter he had seen that Villefort had showed to him recurred to his mind, and every line seemed visible in fiery letters on the wall, like the many Tekel Upharsin of Belshazzar. He said that it was the vengeance of man and not of heaven that had thus plunged him into the deepest misery. He devoted these unknown persecutors to the most horrible tortures he could imagine, and found them all insufficient, because after torture came death, and after death, if not repose, at least that insensibility that resembles it. By dint of constantly dwelling on the idea that repose was death, and, in order to punish, other tortures than death must be invented, he began to reflect of suicide. Unhappy he who, on the brink of misfortune, broods over these ideas. It is one of those dead seas that seem clear and smooth to the eye, but he who unwarily ventures within its embrace finds himself entangled in a quagmire that attracts and swallows him. Once thus ensnared, unless the protecting hand of God snatch him thence, all is over, and his struggles but tend to hasten his destruction. This state of mental anguish is, however, less terrible than the sufferings that precede and the punishment that awaits it. A sort of consolation that points to the yawning abyss, at the bottom of which is darkness and obscurity. Edmund found some solace in these ideas. All his sorrows, all his sufferings, with their train of gloomy spectres, fled from his cell, where the angel of death seemed about to enter. Dante's reviewed with composure his past life, and looking forward with terror to his future existence, chose that middle line that seemed to afford him a refuge. "Sometimes," said he, "in my voyages, when I was a man and commanded other men, I have seen the heavens become overcast, the sea rage and foam, the storm arise, and, like a monstrous bird, cover the sky with its wings. Then I felt that my vessel was a vain refuge that trembled and shook before the tempest. Soon the fury of the waves and the sight of the sharp rocks announced the approach of death, and death then terrified me, and I used all my skill and intelligence as a man and a sailor to escape. But I did so because I was happy, because I had not courted death, because this repose on a bed of rocks and seaweed seemed terrible, because I was unwilling that I, a creature made for the service of God, should serve for food to the gulls and ravens. But now it is different. I have lost all that bound me to life. Death smiles and invites me to repose. I die after my own manner. I die exhausted and broken-spirited, as I fall asleep when I have passed 3,000 times round my cell." No sooner had this idea taken possession of him than he became more composed, arranged his couch to the best of his power, ate little and slept less, and found this existence almost supportable, because he felt he could throw it off at pleasure like a worn-out garment. He had two means of dying,
The one was to hang himself with his handkerchief to the stanchions of the window, the other to refuse food and starve himself. But the former means was repugnant to him. Dantès had always entertained the greatest horror of pirates who are hung up by the yardarm. He would not die by what seemed an infamous death. He resolved to adopt the second, and began that day to execute his resolve. Nearly 4 years had passed away. At the end of the second, he had ceased to mark the lapse of time. Dantès said, "I wish to die," and had chosen the manner of his death, and fearful of changing his mind, he had taken an oath to die. "When my morning and evening meals are brought," thought he, "I will cast them out of the window, and I shall be believed to have eaten them." He kept his word. Twice a day he cast out, by the barred aperture, the provisions his jailer brought him, at first gaily, then with deliberation.